Hello, this is Co-Chair Ruth Richardson. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Select Committee on Racial Justice to order. I just want to verify for the record with staff that there is indeed a quorum present.
Chair Richardson, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Benta. We will move on to the approval of minutes. We have a couple of rounds of minutes to approve. We'll start with the approval of the minutes of the September 22nd meeting. Vice Chair Damuth, have you had a chance to review the minutes from September 22nd?
Thank you, Co-Chair Richardson, I have had an opportunity to review the September 22nd minutes, and I would move that they would be approved.
Thank you, Vice Chair Damuth. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Vice Chair Damuth, we can move on to the September 29th minutes. Have you had a chance to review those as well?
Thank you, Chair Richardson. I have also reviewed the September 29th minutes, and I would move that these would be approved.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. A few reminders for members and the public before we get into today's testimony. Members, we understand that you may need to step away during the hearing, but we are requesting that you please keep your video on when you're participating within the hearing. And as a reminder, instead of a little time at each public testimony, for having public testimony at each hearing, we're dedicating an entire hearing on October 13th at 1 p.m. for public testimony. We will allow 3 hours for this hearing, and people can sign up to testify via Zoom, submit written testimony, or leave a voicemail for testimony if they're unable to appear via Zoom. People should contact CLA Benta Conte to sign up. Information is on the committee webpage, and we will also share more details at the end of today's hearing before we conclude. Members, today's testimony is going to be focused on historical trauma. We will hear from all of the speakers before opening up for members' questions and discussion. And because we have 3 speakers today, time is going to be pretty tight, so we are just going to jump right into the testimony. Members, I'm pleased to introduce to you today Dr. Kate Bean and Ms. Carly Badhart Bull to testify regarding historical trauma and the Indigenous community. I will turn it over to you for your testimony.
Hamitakayapi washichu ya Dr. Kate Bean imakiapie bakotia hedipuin demeye. So in English, my name is Kate Bean, and in Dakota, I am known as Brings Them Home Woman. Damakota, I am Dakota. I'm a citizen of the Wakpai Pakshan Oyate, the Flanders Santee Sioux Nation, which is today a tribe in South Dakota, though originally my people come from Minnesota, where here in the lands where the waters reflect the sky. We are descendants of Black Dogs Village, which was a community that lived in what is now known more broadly as Egan, Minnesota, and a Heato Tunwe, or village to the side, at Bede Makaska. My doctorate is in American Studies from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Go Gophers. I am a former Charles A. Eastman Fellow from Dartmouth College, as well as a President's Postdoc Fellow through the University of California, Santa Cruz. But today I serve as Director of Native American Initiatives at the Minnesota Historical Society, though I do have to mention that I'm not here today as a representative of the Minnesota Historical Society. I definitely wear many hats. And I also am an educator. I serve as adjunct faculty at Minneapolis College, and I'm on a number of boards in my community, including a Minneapolis urban rep for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And I was most recently appointed by Governor Walz to the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board,
but I'm here today as a public historian and private citizen representing my family and community. Pita Maya.
Hami takuyipi, Carly Bad Harpal and Makiapie, Dakota ia tokadakia maniwi miye, Damakota, wakpa ipaksha himataha, nakum bade ota ontue derwatie, iushki and wachian kapie. Hello, friends and relatives. In English, my name is Carly Bad Harpal. In Dakota, it's tokadakia maniwi, which means woman who walks toward the future. I'm also from Flandreau, and I live here in Bade Oto Ontue, or Minneapolis, and I'm happy to see you all here today. Kate and I are twin sisters, so we do share some of our history. So her story, as far as our family and our connection to Minnesota, is very much my story as well. Like Kate, I previously worked as a Dakota language teacher for a program within Minneapolis Public Schools. And then after that, while she ventured into academia, I decided to go to law school. So I'm an alumni of the University of Minnesota Law School. Upon graduation, I clerked for now Justice Ann McCaig, back when she was in family court. And I have also worked as an attorney for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office of their Child Protection Division. Not quite 7 years ago, I decided I was interested in serving my community in a different capacity, and I left the legal world and moved into the field of philanthropy. I worked for 6 years at the Bush Foundation, which is based in St. Paul, Minnesota, first on their education team and then as a program officer with the foundation's work specifically in Indian country, so across Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native Nations. This past April, I moved into a new role as an executive director of a national nonprofit organization called the Native Ways Federation. Our organization was founded by 7 national Native nonprofit organizations with a mission to activate informed giving to Native nonprofits. Our work is largely focused on donor education and advocacy in support of Native-led efforts and initiatives across the country, including here in Minnesota. My sister and I do quite a bit of educating about our communities individually and sometimes together. And when it comes to advocating for support of Native communities and people, very often we have to start with this education element and recognition that people don't know what they don't know. And the fact is, when it comes to Native nations and people, there's a lot that people don't know. A study came out a couple of years ago, which was funded by the Kellogg Foundation and put together by First Nations Development Institute and Echo Hawk Consulting. That study found that it was called Reclaiming Native Truth. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend taking a look at it. You can find it online. But Reclaiming Native Truth found that one of the biggest hurdles to overcoming challenges in our communities is this invisibility factor. They did a national survey which found that 40% of those that they surveyed didn't know that Native people still exist, 40%. And while that may seem like a large number to some, it actually wasn't surprising to many of us who work in Indian country and come from Indian country, we experience this every day. The erasure of our people from conversations, statistics, data, from important conversations that are taking place. And so while we are the original people of this land, we often fall into the other or statistically insignificant category of many reports and studies. And unfortunately, this has had some pretty detrimental effects on our communities. And so that's part of what we're gonna talk about here today. A recent report by NCAI found that 87% of state history standards across the country have no mention of Native American history or people post-1900. Basically, we're treated as the people of the past. And while a lot has happened since 1492 and since 1900, as it relates to our tribal communities and people, we're still very much here. There's no way that we're going to get to the whole comprehensive history of our people and all of our many contributions today. So I just want to kind of tee it up by stating that we're going to cover a lot in a really short period of time. But I highly recommend we both do continuing this education and knowledge building beyond this presentation today. So we're going to be touching the surface, and we're happy to connect afterward, share our knowledge and experience, connect with you and others, or connect you with others who maybe have some more specific expertise in particular topic areas or communities. But we're going to do our best to share what we know and what we've experienced as Dakota people living here in Minnesota. And we thank you for being here today.
So is everyone able to see my screen? Yes? Okay.
Yes.
So as many of you here today probably know, hopefully, here in our home state, we have 11 tribal nations that hold federal recognition and retain reservation lands within the Minnesota borders. When we think more generally about what tribes are from Minnesota, we have to think about what time period we are speaking to. Dakota people's creation stories, and we have more than one, and that's okay, have us entering into the world here in lands today known as Minnesota, the lands where the waters reflect the sky. Both at Bede Wakan, also known as Spirit Lake or Lake Mille Lacs, and Bedote, where the rivers come together down at Wetatonka, but what is today more widely known as Pike Island at Fort Snelling State Park. And again, there is more than one sacred site of creation for us. The way it was described to me by my elders is that we were born into different locations of the earth with the indigenous responsibility of caring for particular lands, which is why we have different bands of peoples and many stories. Our Ojibwe relatives migrated to this area from the east about 1,500 years ago. This history is traced through Ojibwe oral history and preserved in maps of birch bark, as well as confirmed by the archaeological record. According to Ojibwe oral history, seven prophets visited their people and instructed them to move westward to the land where the food grows on water, which we know as wild rice, also known as Manuman in Ojibwe and Psin in Dakota. In the 1720s, Ojibwe families landed on a western shore of Lake Superior and began moving into northern Minnesota. Our Ojibwe or Anishinaabe relatives, like many of us, represent lands across both state and federal borders, but our histories connect us with one another in powerful ways. Other tribes have also lived within these boundaries and have also moved throughout these lands for many years. These peoples include the Iowa, Sac and Fox, Ho-Chunk, and others. As a public historian and a Dakota scholar myself, I work with many representatives of these great nations today in Minnesota. And amongst tribes, there are historic tribal territories that are respected as such. Because of our deep connections to the land and our mutual respect for one another, and yes, our people went to war with one another at times throughout history, but we also traded, intermarried, and had agreements and allies, diplomacy amongst one another as neighbors, as well as at times enemies, but also relatives, which is often not quite so widely shared outside of our communities or within the national narrative that often seems to divide us from one another. When we think of who Native people are in our communities, we also have to think of community members who represent tribal nations that are today situated outside of Minnesota state borders. I'm a dual citizen of this country, a proud Minnesota citizen, but also an enrolled member or a citizen of my tribal nation in South Dakota. Over the years, the simplified categories of urban versus rural tribal members has not actually reflected our realities very well as Native people who also live in the suburbs, in small towns, and who also move between spaces just like anyone else. It's important to remember that each of you today likely has tribal constituents, regardless of whether or not you represent an area that is densely populated by American Indian peoples. And I have a link here to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council webpage, and I'm sure plenty of you are familiar with that. But to let you know a little bit about who Dakota people are specifically, there are many ways of telling and interpreting histories. These ways that many Native scholars approach history is from a combination of sources, including oral histories that are passed down in families and communities, which hold as much validity as the archival record for us, if not more so. We are also often reinterpreting findings in the archive to add to the narratives out there, based on our own cultural teachings, as well as ways of knowing combined with scientific knowledge and scientific evidence. Our voices and our histories matter too. Now, in order to understand the many perspectives of the past, we need to engage with and listen for the voices of those who lived and experienced these time periods firsthand. Often for us as Native peoples, these types of interpretations are told to us by our grandparents and their grandparents, and often interpretations that were never included in the archival record because we were not the ones who created that archival record. But we are here now. And sometimes some of these stories are kept safest in community, while other times we realize that the time has come to speak about painful truths that our grandparents were not always ready to speak of, as they were told to remain silent. And we find that as their grandchildren who hold certain privileges and rights that our grandparents did not, we find that we are their voices today. And that is why they protected us. We are creating safe spaces so that our children will know that their voices and existence matters. This is a map of the homelands of the Ocheti Shakoni, the Seven Council Fires, erroneously called the Sioux, though that was not a name we called ourselves traditionally. We are the Xewichashta, or human beings. We are the Dakota, which means allies, and we are the Eastern Fires of the Ocheti Shakoni. Our Lakota neighbors from the west, whom we also call Tituan, and Nakota, who we also call Ihamtuan, are our close relatives, as we are all part of the same language family and part of the same Wichahbi Oyate, or people of the Star Nation. But we have our own stories of emerging into the world and our own distinct histories as well, based on our geographic locations. There's often confusion about this, but there are essentially three larger dialect groups of the so-called Siouan language family. The Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota, we come from the same people, but different geographic locations, and we speak different dialects of the same language. Minnesota is Dakota Makoche. This is Dakota land. This is a history that is known and a relationship that has been carried on throughout history. That this is Dakota land traditionally does not in any way mean that others are not welcome or that another tribe does not also call this place home. Stating that this is Dakota land is an acknowledgement of the peoples who were created out of this earth and who have taken on the responsibilities of caring for these lands forever, even when we were removed from it. Or find ourselves without a home of our own upon it. This Dakota connection to these lands remains unbroken, and it is a strong and powerful relationship. Of the Dakota peoples, there are four bands, the Badewakantuan, or the Spirit Lake peoples, also sometimes written as Mittawakaton. And so, you know, again, this is an example of different dialects of language, and both are correct. Wakpetuan, the leaf dwellers, Sisituan, people among the fishing grounds, and the Wakpekute, or the leaf shooters. And my sister and I are members of the Badewakantuan and Wakpetuan peoples. These bands lived and traveled through regular seasonal camps throughout the year and resided in different territories over different periods of time. Today, due to the impacts of history, there are four tribal nations who retain lands within these state borders, even though the majority of Dakota people live outside of Minnesota borders. We still have communities in our homelands, and we have to remember that these state borders were not ours. As you can see from this map, we as Dakota people are home wherever we live today. But we are still Dakota, and we still identify as being from these territories, and our creation centers us here. The many Dakota place names of these lands also speak to this history and illustrate for us how our grandparents interpreted the world around them.
So a little background for context is always important. And I do want to mention, you know, as my sister mentioned, we're Dakota. There are four Dakota nations in Minnesota, Makoche, and there's seven Ojibwe or Anishinaabe. And there is no way that we're going to cover all of that history, including with talking about the treaties. So I'm going to give a pretty general overview of the treaty making process and what tribal sovereignty means. But if folks want more information, and I hope you do, on the specifics as it relates to Minnesota nations, please reach out, because we have that information and we have those connections. So let's talk about tribal sovereignty and treaties a little bit. Native nations or tribes and people have a unique political and legal status within the United States boundaries. We have inherent rights and a political relationship with the United States and state governments that does not derive from race or ethnicity, and that's part of what makes us really unique. As a member of a federally recognized tribe, I'm a citizen of a tribal nation. In fact, as a citizen of Flandreau-Santee-Sioux Nation, which is located in South Dakota, I'm living in Minnesota, I'm a sovereign of three nations. My tribal nation, which is Flandreau, Minnesota, which is the state where I reside, and the United States. My mother, who is also a Minnesota resident, is a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Now, I could have been enrolled in her nation because I did meet that tribe's requirements as well, but you can only be enrolled in one tribe, and our family chose to enroll us in our father's tribe, as that's where we had more cultural connections. My husband is a citizen of the Oglala Sioux tribe in South Dakota. Now, based on the citizenship requirements of our respective tribes, our son, who's 3.5 years old, he could be enrolled in either Oglala or Flandreau. But again, he couldn't be enrolled in both. So we will choose where he will be enrolled, and regardless, his family connections will continue at both. And we will strive to raise him in maintaining those connections with his Lakota and his Dakota roots. So just a little bit about tribal enrollment. And I also think it's important, just as a side note, to mention, not all of your constituents are citizens of their nations. For various reasons, they may not meet the various citizenship requirements of their respective nations, and yet they may still identify ethnically as Native. In addition, many of your constituents who are citizens of Minnesota tribes, or many of your constituents are citizens of Minnesota tribes, but many are citizens of nations from outside of Minnesota, such as my sister and I. And yet we do consider this our homeland. So just a little bit of context. I'm happy to share more for folks who are interested. Now, tribal sovereignty, you know, what does that mean? This is really important. Sovereignty is a legal word for the concept of having the authority to self-govern. This power that our tribal nations hold and have held since before Europeans ever made contact is what allows our nations or tribes to each manage their own affairs outside of state and federal governments. Amongst other powers, this includes the power to hold elections, the power to determine citizenship. As I mentioned, the different tribes can have different citizenship requirements, as is their right as sovereign nations, and the power to engage in government-to-government relationships. So every tribal nation in Minnesota has retained their sovereignty. Every tribal nation across the U.S. has retained their sovereignty. And many that has been through a process of negotiation with the U.S. government, where the federal government has largely, unfortunately, not withheld their end of the bargain. And this includes the process of treaty making. So across the country, you know, we mentioned there's 11 tribes in Minnesota. Across the country, there are currently 574 tribes in the U.S. These tribes have many unique languages, cultural practices, governing structures. Minnesota tribal government structures also vary due to differences in treaties and with agreements made with U.S. governments, as well as differences in traditional structures that existed pre-contact. In the U.S., hundreds of treaties, along with the Supreme Court, the President, and congressional action, have recognized and affirmed tribal sovereignty and that inherent power of self-government. And that's really important to recognize. Under the U.S. Constitution, these treaties are the supreme law of the land, and they are intended to take precedence over conflicting state laws. Also very important to note, treaties were and are an exchange and acknowledgement of rights that were already in existence. They're not a granting of rights, and that's something that can often be mistaken. Treaties ultimately created a contract between the United States and the federal, between tribes and the federal government, often outlining exchanges of land, hunting and fishing rights, which oftentimes included land outside of reservation boundaries, and guarantees of peace and protection. Treaties also often included specific promises by the U.S. government that in exchange for certain things, namely land, that Native people would be provided for in terms of health care, education, housing, economic development, and agricultural assistance. Now, these promises were made as an assurance of the success of tribal communities, but again, unfortunately, many of these promises were not kept. It should also be recognized that the treaties were often made under some pretty unethical and underhanded contexts. The treaties were in English. The Native signers were dependent upon translators, which were hired and paid for by the U.S. government. It was uncertain if the terms of the contracts had the same meaning for each party, and it also wasn't always clear that those signing the documents had the authority to do so on behalf of their communities. Nevertheless, these agreements established what is known under federal law as the federal trust responsibility in protection of tribal lands, governments, and people. These obligations resulted in the creation of government departments and agencies such as Indian Health Services, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Indian Education. However, these agencies and the promises that they were made have historically been severely underfunded, and our tribal nations, communities, and people have suffered greatly as a result. While previous treaty making processes ended in the late 1800s, the agreements still exist unless specific action was taken to ensure otherwise, and are still legally binding. And also, the federal government continues to enter into contracts and compacts with tribal nations, and as do state governments. One very important takeaway from this section is that we remain sovereign nations. However, our ability to exercise sovereignty is something that we've had to continuously educate on and fight for over the years.
So in addition to not living up to the promises that were made through treaties, the federal government has also negatively impacted tribal nations and people through numerous federal policy measures. Language was written into treaties requiring that we as Native people change who we are and who we have always been. These were policies such as the Indian Removal Act, which was first drafted by John C. Calhoun, the founder of the Bureau of Indian Affairs under the War Department, and signed into law by President Andrew Jackson in May of 1830. This act led to policies of removal for Southern tribes and acts of genocide, such as the Cherokee Trail of Tears. Here in Minnesota, more specifically, we saw the Removal Acts of 1863, which followed the Dakota War of 1862. And I know committee member Representative Erdahl has been involved with addressing this particular issue with community members more recently. But the Dakota War era is most definitely a traumatic time period for many of us. And part of healing from this history involves having the platform and opportunity to speak our many truths. We have many different perspectives and stories and experiences when it comes to telling this history. We as Dakota people are doing more of this today, and we also have many commemorative walks, runs, and horseback rides that we organize and participate in order to honor our relatives and to try and reconnect with one another. These are our sort of memorials. The fact is, our people are still trying to reconnect with one another as families separated by the war, and we are still trying to return home in different ways. For far too many years, this history was not talked about, or it was only interpreted by people from outside of our communities and outside of our perspectives. Our memories were not shared. We also must take a hard look at why these policies of removal were drafted and be truthful about why they were enforced as a way to remove us from our lands and as acts of discrimination against us for remaining Indigenous. We were prosecuted for being Native, and tribal peoples throughout the world have experienced this during histories of colonization. But we survived. And it is also imperative that we understand that this time period was not so long ago. These were our grandparents' grandparents. Our relatives were interned at this concentration camp below Fort Snelling, and our great-grandfather, Makpiawi Chasha, a warrior and leader in our community at Xiato Tumwe, he died here. He was an elder who did not even fight in battle during the war. Yet today, his remains are still somewhere in a mass grave that has yet to be located. We, like many peoples, we have ceremonial protocols and ways of burying that were not done. And this is unresolved grief. Our grandmother used to tell us a story about her grandmother fleeing from Minnesota on horseback during the Dakota War. And for many years as a child, I did not know what it was she was fleeing from. It's not as if I would be taught in school about my own people. But I was privileged in that my grandparents knew how to read and write in Dakota, which they had learned at the Santee Normal Training School in Nebraska, where they were taken after the removal from Minnesota. And as an adult, I read my grandparents' journals to better understand what they had experienced. But again, this was a history that I didn't learn. My sister and I did not learn this history in school. In fact, it would not be until our first college classes with a Dakota professor at the University of Minnesota before we received a single lesson about our own people in this state's educational system. The insufficiencies we have seen in education and in this state's narrative by not adequately including Native history in curriculum over the years has created a situation where there are multiple generations of people, both Native and non-Native, who feel as though the truth of our state has been kept from them. And I see this every semester when I teach. And I, you know, I think that is just so imperative that we include this history for every Native student sitting in a history classroom feeling like they are invisible, or worse yet, like they want to disappear. This is also unresolved grief.
So let's talk just a little bit more about Native education. Native nations, people, and families continue to be impacted by a very long and unfortunately very recent history of federal Indian policies focused on American Indian cultural assimilation. And these were often conducted through broad-based education policy. Research indicates that education is the strongest predictor of long-term health. Unfortunately for Native people, the U.S. education system has been used in many ways as a weapon or a tool to destroy our cultural connections and communities. As early as 1819, after the passage of the Indian Civilization Act, the U.S. Indian Wars and the implementation of forced relocation policy, the United States government mandated the education of Native children with a goal of forced assimilation. So this has been happening for a while. The idea was to remove the child's connection to their cultural identity and to replace it with an identity more reflective of dominant or white societal norms. There's a famous quote which many of you I'm sure have heard by Captain Richard Pratt. He founded one of the first off-reservation boarding schools called Carlisle Boarding School. The quote is, "Kill the Indian and save the man." Carlisle served as a model, as did this slogan, for most of the schools that came after it. And it was focused, and it served as a model in that it was focused on systemically stripping away tribal culture. Children were often punished for speaking their native languages. Their long hair, which is an important cultural element, was often cut. And traditional roles and practices were replaced by Western-based education methods. This process carried out through boarding schools lasted from the mid-1800s through well into the 1960s. There were close to 350 government-funded church-run Indian boarding schools across the country in the 19th and 20th centuries. Now, there's a ton of academic literature on this area, and we have tremendous scholars and community members right here in Minnesota who are experts, such as Dr. Brenda Child, who's Ojibwe, from Minnesota. She's at the University of Minnesota. Her book, Boarding School Seasons, is a great resource. Just last week was Orange Shirt Day, a commemorative project day or day of remembrance in our community that originated in Canada because they have a similar history, but it originated there to remember Indigenous children who survived the boarding school era and to acknowledge and bear witness and to support the healing of those who survived these experiences themselves, because many of our survivors are still with us here today. They survived this attempt at cultural genocide, and their descendants, who may not have lived to speak, and some of our descendants also may not have lived to speak about this history or share those painful experiences, and so we're trying to, in many ways, share that for them. Now, our grandparents, my sister Kate and I, grew up in boarding school, and we want to share a video quickly of a relative of ours, one of our grandfathers. His name is Sidney Bird. He's since passed a few years ago. He was Dakota. He was a citizen of Flandreau, the community that we come from, but he grew up in Pine Ridge, and so you'll notice he identifies as Lakota in the video, likely because that's the dialect, that's the language he spoke, and he grew up amongst that community, but he was from Flandreau and his family was from Minnesota originally. So we're going to share that video briefly. Oh, I can't hear it. No, it doesn't want to share the audio with us.
Oops. All right. Well, we tried, so I apologize. It doesn't look like that one's going to work, but we'll go ahead.
You know, we can send it out to someone. Let us know who we should send it to, and we'll share this. Yeah. Because it is, I think, a really good, it's a firsthand account of somebody who experienced the boarding school era. And he talks about, in the video, he talks about being a six-year-old child and away from his family and being scared and as a speaker being told he can't speak his language. And he talked about the loneliness of what that was like. But then he also talks, and this is what I love about the video, and in which I, it makes me cry when I watch it, but he also talks about the strength and the resiliency of our people. He talks about how as Dakota people, we take care of each other, and how that's how he got through that time was through his relationships with other Lakota people. And so again, we'll make sure to share that with folks. And if you have a chance, I really do hope that you take a look at it. Now, unfortunately, his story, Grandpa Sid's story, wasn't unique in many ways. When you talk to Native people, we all have boarding school stories, whether they're our own or family members. You know, Kate and I have stories of our grandfather hopping trains as a child, trying to escape from boarding school. He went to Susan in Rapid City, and he was his parents died when he was very little, and he and his siblings were dispersed amongst various boarding schools. Some of them grew up knowing each other, and some of them didn't. We never knew his birthday, but they came up with one. But he had a lot of stories, and some of them he shared, and many of them he did not, because I think they were probably too painful. My mother-in-law grew up away from her family at boarding school, and she's in her early 70s. She went to Mardi Mission. So the point being, this is very recent history. This isn't something from a long time ago. We our relatives have been through this era, and as a result, we, the next generation, are still dealing with the effects of it. The negative impacts of these years of educational policies, which were intentionally aimed at stripping away our culture, have had some detrimental effects. And unfortunately, again, that was the intent, right? Kill the Indian, save the man. Now, bringing that forward to some current context, you know, generational poverty, the issues associated with that, inadequate support systems for students, student and family health concerns that impact attendance, insufficient funding for academic programs, underdeveloped and very limited culturally appropriate and relevant educational programs, all of these things are issues in our educational systems. They all are impacting Native student success rates. Just a little bit of data to share. American Indian youth have the lowest graduation rates, 69%, far below the national average of 81%. And so that's some national data. And still worse, 8% of Native students across the country who attend BIE, or Bureau of Indian Education, again, an agency that was established due to the federal trust responsibility because of treaties, 8% of Native students attending BIE-funded schools are doing even worse. They have an average graduation rate of 53%. Now, in Minnesota specifically, statewide, our four-year graduation rates increased to 84%. However, the rates for Native students have actually declined by 0.02% in recent years. And they've hovered around 50% for many years, which is, again, below the national average. According to some 2017 data that I was recently looking at, Minnesota ranked 44th among the United States for American Indian graduation rates, 44th. And it ranked 35th overall. And I got that data from Minnesota Compass. And yet that's despite the fact that we are intelligent, we are resilient people. And so, you know, what's the deal, right? You know, our Native students have some of the lowest graduation rates in the country. Why is this? It's because of everything we're talking about today. It's because of the history. It's because of systemic racism. It's because of, you know, this huge distrust in education systems that, quite frankly, who wouldn't be distrustful? They were initially set up to harm us, to harm our communities. And so due to these, the fact that these policies and these systems were put in place to disconnect us from who we are as Dakota and Anishinaabe people, and have continued to create barriers to our people, to our youth, to be connecting to who we are as Indigenous people, you know, that's a huge problem. And my sister and I, we understand these numbers really well. Just from a personal perspective, quite frankly, we're part of these statistics. We dropped out of high school when we were 15. We were disenfranchised by this education system that did not support us, did not support our strengths. The curriculum didn't mention our people, didn't mention our family stories. And if it did, it was not from an Indigenous perspective. According to them, we were savages. We were people who were in the way of progress and had to be dealt with. We were a people who had to be conquered and who then virtually disappeared once Columbus arrived. That doesn't help. And when we came back to Minnesota in our 20s, we came back here to study our language at the University of Minnesota. And it was studying our language and it was learning our history, it was learning our stories that really reconnected us to this land and to who we are as Dakota people. Through studying our language, through learning and reconnecting to our cultural identity, we became empowered. We became empowered to be successful, and we've since dedicated ourselves, albeit in different ways, to helping others, in particular young people, to have access to this opportunity because we think it's really important.
So today we know that historical trauma, as a definition, it's the cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations emanating from massive group trauma. This pain that was being passed down from one generation to the next in our communities, this unresolved grief, was for many years not properly acknowledged, addressed, or treated. In the 1980s, Dr. Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart of the Tokini Institute in South Dakota conceptualized the specific term historical trauma for our Lakota relatives, and it has become more widely used since that time. There are numerous examples that we can give you today about the harmful impacts on Native peoples in Minnesota due to the hardships that our ancestors experienced throughout history. We have only lightly touched on a few, but the fact remains that intergenerational and historical trauma have lasting effects on our communities, our families, and our children today. From issues of mental and physical health, substance abuse, and homelessness, we have to know that all of these issues are rooted in history. These are known, there are reasons why we are where we are today, and these are the effects. Alcohol, for example, this was introduced to our communities by the men drafting the treaties during the treaty era as a way to get us to sign these documents that were not written in our own languages. These photographs here show different periods of time where our relatives did not feel welcome here at home in our lands in Minnesota. And they are deeply connected, though they are, you know, almost 100 years, over 100 years apart. The first is a photograph titled Chief Little Crow's Wife and Children at Fort Snelling. This is a photograph of non-combatant women and children as prisoners after the war. No names for them are even provided, as is often the case for women in particular in the archival record. Some evidence points of this being a woman with the English name of Isabella Wakeman, which means that these children were likely amongst those who started our community with our grandparents in Flandreau, South Dakota. And these were their last days of living in Minnesota, uprooted from their homes. The second photograph is from an archive from a Star Tribune journalist. The caption for the photo reads, "An American Indian family protesting a lack of adequate housing for Indians in Minneapolis is camping out on the lawn of the Lutheran Service Center. Mr. and Mrs. Eddie Benton say they have no other place to house themselves and their three boys." At least here we have the names, right? So that's progress. But what is the photo telling us? When we think about these time periods and what led to the situations at hand, we are reminded of the wall of forgotten natives here in Minneapolis today. And we have to recognize that our struggles are not yet over, and yet we still have so much more work to do to support one another. In 2015, Minnesota's American Indian residents were homeless at 17 times the rate white Minnesotans were, a rate that actually represented an improvement over a much greater gap during the Great Recession, according to the Minnesota Homeless Study conducted by Wilder Research. Our great city of Bede Otta, Minneapolis, is the home of the American Indian Movement, which was born out of the Red Power Movement and the Civil Rights Movements of the 1960s. Eddie Benton, in this photograph here, he was one of the founders of AIM. And we must know and acknowledge that Native history here. The United States government's efforts to assimilate American Indians into mainstream culture can be seen throughout the 20th century in the BIA activities. In 1953, the United States Congress established a new policy towards American Indians called termination.
This policy eliminated much governmental support for Indian tribes and ended the protected land trust status of all Indian-owned lands. In response to this policy, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began a voluntary urban relocation program. And American Indians could move from their rural tribes to metropolitan areas such as Chicago, Denver, Los Angeles, and Minneapolis, though the BIA pledged initial assistance with locating housing and employment. Thousands of American Indians made the move to cities were strategically placed at a distance from one another to discourage community building, and they did not have sustainable support. They struggled to adjust to life in the cities with unemployment, low-end jobs, discrimination, homesickness, homelessness, and the loss of traditional cultural supports. The urban relocation program changed the face of cities as well as American Indian communities. And when our community members sought each other out and united, we saw the creation of AIM, of Little Earth Housing, and of spaces like the Minneapolis Indian Center.
Another era that's or area that's important to recognize as it's had a historic impact on our communities and that we still face to this day is the removal of American Indian children from our families. So the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA as it's known, federal law was enacted to protect the best interests of Indian children by setting very minimum federal standards for states in handling the removal and placement of Indian children. Now, this law requires that certain actions happen to ensure that children have been given the opportunity to be placed within their families and tribal communities where possible. This is in an effort to reduce this historic pattern of removal and disconnection that unfortunately so many Native kids and many now adults have experienced. The ICWA law came to be following years of organizing by Native people, tribes, organizations, and allies due to the incredibly disproportionate number of Native children who were being removed from their families and placed with white families. At the time, the number of American Indian children in out-of-home placement, so this was prior to 1978, was approximately 1 in 4. In some states, such as Minnesota, this rate was as high as 35%. And up to 90% of Native children were placed with non-Indian families. And this is, you know, where their chances of being connected to their tribal communities and cultural identities were, again, further diminished. And this included also where fit and able relatives were available. Unfortunately, the numbers of Native families in the system and of children being removed from their families has not gotten better. In fact, in many ways, it's gotten worse. Removal rates of American Indian kids have increased over the years. A 2017 study, specifically in regards to Minnesota, reported that American Indian children were removed at a rate of 18.5 times more than white children across the state. Now, previous to working in the field of philanthropy and the nonprofit sector, I worked at Hennepin County Attorney's Office in their Child Protection Division. I also worked for the ICWA Law Center during and immediately following law school, representing families in the system. So I've sat on different sides of the table here and can say that, you know, it's astounding what people don't know. This is federal law, and there's a reason for it. And this is an area that's very close to my heart, and I just want to share that we have some amazing resources, again, here in Minnesota, including the ICWA Law Center and some other folks. And so please, if you want more information, please reach out. Now, I want to talk a little bit about community health issues before we look to the future. Everyone deserves the opportunity of good health. So while Minnesota is often named one of the healthiest states in the nation, there's significant disparities in health factors, health outcomes in Minnesota between the state's majority white population and its population of color and American Indians. So beginning at birth and beyond, according to the Minnesota Department of Health, Native babies are 3 times more likely to die as infants than white babies. Life expectancies for American Indians are the lowest of any other ethnic group in Minnesota at 70 years old. In fact, life expectancies are worse for American Indians in Minnesota than they are for American Indians in the United States as a whole. Native people continue to die at higher rates than any other populations in many categories of preventable illnesses. The premature death rate for American Indians in Minnesota is 3 times higher than the rate for white residents. suicide rates are significantly higher for folks in our communities than any other demographic. And recent data shows that American Indian suicide rates in Minnesota are nearly twice the rate of American Indians nationwide. So we have a lot of work to do here. In addition to economic stability, health issues, lack of quality education, all these things that we're talking about, access to healthy food is another huge issue. There are a ton of tribal and nonprofit efforts across the state working to address this issue, and they need further support. So there's an incredible food sovereignty movement underway, led by organizations like the folks at Dream of Wild Health, local chef Sean Sherman, also known as the Sioux Chef, who are educating both non-Native and Native folks alike about the benefits of Indigenous foods. One example of a food sovereignty effort that's close to our hearts is wild rice. And so that's something I think for many of you, Minnesota is famous for our wild rice. It's a part of our cultural identity as Native people, huge historical, spiritual, and cultural significance. And due to colonization, land loss, establishment of reservations, dependence on government rations, many of our people have been distanced from that traditional food source, but our communities are finding our way back and taking ownership of that. And so that's just another area that I think is really important to recognize and where, you know, we need help, you know, with issues that are emerging, such as climate change, water quality issues, pipelines, other human influence, environmental factors. It's a big issue in our communities. So, looking toward the future, I know we're short on time here and we're gonna wrap up. Our communities have the answers, or we're best equipped to find the answers to address the issues that we're facing. However, we need the support and resources to adequately plan for and implement the solutions. So much of what we share today is directly connected to the historic disenfranchisement of our people and our nations. You know, we come from a people that dominant society at one point in time wanted to disappear, whether physically or culturally. But the fact is we're still here. You know, my sister and I, we speak to you today because of the legacy of our ancestors. They struggled and thrived through hardships and successes so that we could be here today on Zoom of all things, which is crazy to think about, talking to you. So we have a responsibility to them, right? And we have a responsibility to our kids. My sister and I are both mothers of young children, and to their kids, as do you. So there's tremendous work that's happening in Indian country to address the issues that we've talked about today. But historically, they've been severely under-resourced by government and by philanthropy, and often face a lot of bureaucratic battles. So from food sovereignty, language revitalization, you know, our people are working to heal and to thrive on our own terms. But we really do need help to make this happen.
And I would just end by saying too, you know, what we need is hope. What we need is positive and accurate stories along with truth telling. We need a lot of things, right? But our children must know their worth and the strength of where they come from. My sister and I, we come from a family that doesn't shy away from hard truths and the difficult work that has to be taken on in our communities. We come from a family of activists, scholars, educators, and leaders. Our grandfather, Charles Eastman, who my sister is named after, was one of the first Native American medical doctors and one of the first writers of world renown to be born in Minnesota. We know what our communities need to survive, to remain Indigenous. And as mothers, we see what works with our own children. We just need others to listen. We need others to be open to hearing from us, and we need your support. So wopita tanka e chichi apie, immense gratitude to you all.
Thank you, Carly and Dr. Bean, for that presentation. We appreciate you not only sharing your stories, but your perspective as well. And we also appreciate you being willing to stay until the end so that we can move into the next presentation and then open it up for question and answers. Members, I'm pleased to introduce Mr. Sam Simmons to testify regarding historical trauma in the African American community. Mr. Simmons, you now have the floor.
Well, I want to thank everyone in the committee for allowing me to be here. I am a behavioral consultant, been doing this kind of work for the last 30 years. I'm also a licensed chemical dependency counselor. A lot of my work in the recent years has been more around addressing community trauma, more specifically Black male trauma. I'm also the co-organizer of the Community Empowerment Through Black Men Healing Conference that we just celebrated our last, our 12th year, which is a conference in terms of really getting an understanding of how does continuous long-term trauma, what kind of effects it has on a community, and what kind of effects it might have on individuals outside the community. So I'm going to do my best to share that understanding here today through a community story, from intergenerational trauma to thriving. I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. So trauma is a fact of life, and it does not, however, have to be a life sentence. So here we have a definition of trauma that I prefer to use in it. Anything that happens too much, too fast, too soon, for anybody to metabolize, to move through it, and when it happens, they get stuck. And the reason I really appreciate this particular definition is that in doing this work around trauma and historical trauma and community trauma, is there would be periodically I would get a person in the audience who would say things like, "Well, bad things happened to me, and I turned out just fine." And I realized in when this would happen, probably more than 70% of the time, it usually was a male. And even within that 70%, it usually was a white male. And my response to them was, ask your family. Because one of the things I've also known in doing this work is families have a tendency to hide the so-called head of the house or the white male's trauma behind closed doors. So another reason I really appreciate this definition is not everybody is not affected by events the same. And a lot of it does have to do with, you know, what age they were, the extent of the trauma, the support they had or didn't have, really has a major effect on how people are affected by these traumatic events. The other important thing is that a trauma is not a personal failure or defect. It's something that happens to people. Because, you know, the old saying, bad things happen to good people. Well, bad things happen to everybody. So as my two Native sisters talked about their experiences and talked about Dr. Braveheart's work, I, in terms of doing my work, in terms of trying to talk about the experience of the African-American community, I actually started my journey in really appreciating Dr. Braveheart's work and the fact that Dr. Braveheart was trying to really look at the idea of why haven't Native Americans experienced the American dream. And so as Dr. Braveheart did that, later on, Dr. Joy DeGruy did this in terms of talking about the effects of chattel slavery on a group of people. And not only chattels, how did chattel slavery have an effect on a people, but having the experience of chattel slavery, about 240 years of chattel slavery, followed by institutional racism and oppression. And how did that have, what kind of ways? Because if we look at trauma, one way to look at it is you find a way adapt to the experience or adapt to the residuals of those experiences. And some of them are reflecting resiliency, which we as Black people we're all often give credit as we're strong people and resilient people. But my question to that is, no people should have to be resilient for many years, and definitely for 400. And when do we have a chance to really talk about what it means to be more than just resilient in terms of being able to thrive? And so we have a couple ways that we can adapt to this experience. It could be, as I mentioned, the resilience, and the other that could be harmful or destructive. And the interesting thing about this is I do a group with young men between the ages of 18, American men, 18 to 35, around who might have had some issues with either maybe domestics, some kind of assault, or some other violation that they might have had under probation. And one of the things that I've done a little differently than some of my counterparts is we spend more time talking about them and their trauma, which is they find very different. You know, it's like, yeah, they're sent to me as deemed or as titled as a problem, and we'll talk about that later on, or as a perpetrator. But every perpetrator I have dealt with, for the most part, has been a victim of something that never got resolved. And so in doing that, you know, I remember one of the young men, his grandma wanted to know what was, you know, why every Tuesday at a certain time he was in such a kind of a, in her mind, in her words, a panic to go to some group, you know, because this was a little unusual for him. And she says, where are you going? And he told her, Mr. Sam's group. And she says, well, what did they talk about in Mr. Sam's group? And she said, he said, we talk about trauma. And this is his grandmother. And she said, well, why is he talking about all this negative stuff? You know, and you tell him we're resilient people and quit being negative. So he came back, he told me, and I, you know, he told me what his grandma said. And I said, tell your grandma, thank you. I said, but what do you, when you hear the word resiliency, what does that mean to you? And what he said was, we're still here. Basically mean they haven't killed us all yet. And basically built in just surviving. And what we've learned over time, when people are stuck in just surviving or moment to moment, that's not good for them or folks around them. So with post-traumatic slave syndrome, there's scholars who says that this still has a major effect on family relationships to this day. Racial oppression is a traumatic form of interpersonal violence which can lacerate the spirit, scar the soul, and puncture the psyche. So racial trauma is trauma based on race, refers to events that endanger relates to real and perceived experiences of racial discrimination. So we're talking about things that includes threats, injury, humiliation, shaming events, and witnessing harm of others, you know, again, due to real or perceived racism. And so the thing is, you know, I know that there's individuals who talk about, well, I don't know about this racism thing, but if everybody that's in my group, part of my particular race, have the same or similar experiences, that would appear to be racism to me. But short of that is that those experiences are real, and they're consistent, and there's some, and they still are validated. They still should be validated if a person agreed about racism or not, you know. And so you see here it says injury, humiliation, or shaming events, which brings up to me this conversation about which is a taboo conversation right now about good police. My question has always been, since I'm a 66-year-old black man, that the policeman who stops me, and this is a real experience, who stopped me and says, how can you afford this car? Is he a good policeman? Or is he a good policeman because I didn't die in the encounter? Or the policeman who stops me and says that my taillight is out when the taillight is not, because I know it, because I drive fairly new cars, or says, ask me, is this your car? And all you got to do is look at your computer. And then go out of their way to shame me in front of my children. And then at the end, talk about have a nice day. Is that still a good cop? Or is it only a good cop because I'm not dead? So sometimes I think we need to have a broader conversation about this, because I think we're talking about an attitude about a group of people and keeping them in place. And that's just my experience. And if, again, our experiences, you don't always have to agree with what I say, but this is my experience. So racial trauma sometimes goes unnoticed, but you have this heavy weight. You know, it's always the saying, I have to, as a black person, I have to work twice as hard as a white person to get the same thing. And what I've learned over the years in doing this work, working twice as hard don't necessarily mean I'm gonna get the same thing. I've seen individuals of my community do work twice as hard, get multiple degrees, and work for an idiot. So you don't always, working twice as hard don't always get you what you do, but that's that invisible weight around being noticed in terms of classified, those wounds of the of your past, of wanting to do better than your family and feeling like I have to have this extra weight on, I have to do twice as hard and work twice as hard. So this invisible weight that we feel that sometimes we can't describe. It even impairs our ability to speak up for ourselves from time to time. And so what happens is when this experience builds up, this humiliating or devaluing of me as a human being builds up, then we end up with the wounds of rage. And the wounds of rage, unfortunately, doesn't work out in some cases for anybody. Because rage is a very complex emotion. You know, it appears as anger or, you know, that kind of thing, but it comes up as explosive and sadness and depression. But rage, uncontrolled rage, will have you do things that might not be in your best interest in the long run, but feel good in the moment. This accumulation of folks not hearing you, this accumulation of your experience because they don't believe your experience is of any value, because it's not their experience, is not important. Chapter one. So we're going to talk about the African-American trauma experience, and we're talking about African-Americans who have American slavery in their background. See, not all African-Americans have this. My cattle at home are better cared for than these unfortunate persons. This is a Union Army officer who had never been to a Southern slave plantation, and even he could see that these enslaved Africans were treated less than human, even less than his own cattle. So this is a public sale of Negro proclamation. And, you know, if you read through this, let me see. She has four children, one girl about 13 years of age, another seven, a boy of five, and an infant 11 months old. And two of the children will be sold with their mother and the other separately if the best suits the purchaser. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. Both sides of my family are you know, descendants of slaves. This could very, very, very well be a purchase for one of my family members. So this is real. So chattel slavery. So when we talk about chattel slavery, you know, because again, when I first started talking about this historical trauma from an African-American perspective, you know, because, you know, when folks can't handle certain truth, they call it emotional dissonance. They want to shut down the messenger because it conflicts with their own truth. You know, it's like having a grandparent that you grew up believing that was the greatest thing in the town, and probably was. The great things have brought a lot of prosperity to the town and that kind of thing. And then you get evidence that great family member is a pedophile. So the challenge is, do you stop loving them How do you handle that? And what some people might do when we talk about emotional dissonance, where they will attack the messenger because they can't handle that truth. Because the issue is if I accept that truth, then everything I believe was true is wrong. And that's not necessarily true. Might be not necessarily wrong, but might be distorted with the information or the lack of information you had. But back to chattel slavery. You know, chattel slavery was unique because it was one of the only slaveries, because I used to get this thing, well, you know, Mr. Simmons, I don't know why you'd make it a big deal about this slavery thing, because, you know, slavery was part of mankind. It's in the Bible. And I always like that period, in the Bible. See, when people say in the Bible, I'm supposed to be quiet. And they're right. It is. But when we don't have time to break down the aspects of slavery and differences. But chattel slavery was one of the only slaveries that literally bred human beings. They were breeding farms in, I thought they were in Mississippi. I heard of them. But actually, two of the biggest breeding farms were in Baltimore, Maryland. Because in 1808, it was against the law to import African-Americans, but they still needed African Americans or enslaved Africans to still pick the cotton. And also what was interesting is they knew that the ones that they breed would be hopefully less hostile. Because think about it, you bring brand new bodies from Africa and go through this arduous journey if you made it. Your rebellion and your humanity will have you fight back, which over time became more of a problem. So one, we just raise our own, just like you would some cattle, some, you know, tame cattle. Typical slave family was matriarch conform. One of the things I always like to inform people is when we think about the African-American community, if we look at sociology books, they talk about African-Americans are a matriarchal system. We didn't come here as a matriarchal system. We came from many different kinds of systems, some patriarchal, some more collaborative, and some where they were led by women, but they were led by women in partnership with the man. This matriarchal system is a made-up system for us since we've been here. Think about it. We're talking about a slave quarters, and every plantation that had more than two or three slaves had slave quarters, and they had one spokesman. That one spokesman would usually probably be a black woman or a really, really old black man. And that was because the white male slave owner couldn't handle the fact of allowing that black male to feel like he had any kind of power. And sometimes that slave owner would go out of his way to let that prize breeder, that's what they called a male, slave prize breeder, because, you know, again, you know, have them real strong babies. You go into slave quarters and you go in and he asks, say, Martha, how are things going on here? She tells him, he pinches her on the cheek like she's a child and says, thank you. And then, you know, we have this male breeder and we have this little girl, Sally, 10 years old, sitting in the corner playing with a doll, and he asked Martha, is Sally ripe yet? Now, this is his prize breeder child. Martha knows that he's upset, and she gives him the look. That look still exists today. Don't you dare, because she knows if anything happened to Master, everybody pays. And her response about little Sally is she's not ripe yet. She can't stop it, but she might be able to give the little child some time. That puts that black woman in a bad position because now she got to defend for that child. She's trying to keep this black man alive. And at times, Master might say, well, you can come with me. And that still exists to this day in that position. And over time, some of us as black males have resented black women to be in that position. And not only black males, but white females, because a lot of times that male slave showed her more respect than he did his own wife. The system of slavery encouraged whites to unify around race rather than class. So what do I mean by that? As whites came from, for example, they were Irish, English, all these different cultures. And in this system of American racism, white becomes before your other identity. So slavery's over. We have the Jim Crow. So the 13th Amendment, slavery abolished, abolished slavery and the voluntary except for punishment. So now all of a sudden, South ain't ready to really pay no black folks. And then on top of that, do you understand a black male body after slavery wasn't worth much unless it was either in prison or put to work? So lynching becomes even more popular. Now think about this. We got folks who have the Civil War and they are mad at black people. And what we find when we look at, when we examine lynching, that a good portion of these folks lynched were actually well-to-do black folks doing well. How dare you? That whole what we call the uppity nigger syndrome. How dare you feel like you better than me? And so here we have a picture. This picture is from Duluth. Now, the thing is now, that information is more. We have a monument up in Duluth pertaining to this. But the most difficult thing for me is they used to take these kind of pictures, and they took this picture and made it into a postcard. How much more dehumanization can we get? Now, this is usually ends up being controversial because, again, we're talking about emotional dissonance. But historians have actually continuously said that the slave patrols and night watchmen, which became the modern day police departments, were designed to control the behaviors of minority. The first organized police force were various slave patrols. Policing in this country has always been, had a dual purpose of maintaining social order and enforcing racial hierarchy. The Great Migration was a result of domestic terrorism. Domestic terrorism. My family was terrorized off of their land. We lost land on both sides of our family because of domestic terrorism. We even had issues here in Minnesota. 1919, the Red Summer, following a year after World War I, there was riots in 28 different cities. You know what some of these riots were about? They were about black men standing up for themselves. Remember, one of the things about black people, we believed in the American dream sometime at our peril and sometime more than other white folks. Do you understand that African Americans have fought in every war in our country? Every war. With the ideal that if we proved our bravery, that the country would love us back. 1919, some of them riots were black men wore their uniforms because they fought in World War I and says, we're no longer going to be treated than less than a citizen. And their white counterparts told them, if you wear that uniform in public, we will lynch you. That same uniform we are told we are supposed to respect. Not only did they do that to African Americans, they did it to some natives and Latinas as well. Black folks, okay, so you don't want to live with us, you don't like us, so we start our own cities. Now we have a long list of black cities that were destroyed by their white counterparts over. Real vague and really non-existing excuses, and mostly because they usually were doing better than their white counterparts. You had Black Wall Street, which is a total government. And in my studies, I realized there was a lot of Black Wall Streets where they were economically and financially, because the black community believed in saving their money, sending their kids to school, dressing well to prove that they weren't like the stereotypes that were in the papers at the time. And they've been trying to do that ever since. One last thing. 1955, 14-year-old Emmett Till, brutally murdered. Matter of fact, his cousin lives here in Minnesota and does a lot of work around this. And the reason I bring this up is I was born in 1954 when my parents immigrated to Springfield, Illinois. I was 6 months old. And so our family is in Charleston, South Carolina. Every 2 years, we took that 24-hour drive to Charleston, South Carolina in that dark so we wouldn't get stopped by the police or harassed by the police. We'd go make sure we were in certain states at night so we can get through there without no harassment. I never seen downtown Charleston until I was 35 years old. And that was when I went downtown, went to Charleston as an adult on my own. You know why I never seen downtown Charleston is because of Emmett Till. Our cousins were so afraid that these little northern kids wouldn't know how to act in downtown Charleston. And they were so afraid of us being killed, they never allowed us to go downtown. Now we got, you know, I know some people don't necessarily like this title, but we got it anyway. Ghetto Drug War Era. So we got urban renewal, and urban renewal really was this whole thing about relocating African-Americans and African-Americans and poor folks. And this is also during the time when they built the freeway system. And it was interesting is when I was able to travel, when I would go to different communities or different cities around the country, the Black community, I always would hear these stories of these thriving communities before the freeway came through. You know, if it only happens in one city or maybe two, okay, maybe it's an accident. But when you go to multiple cities and get the same story, that's not no accident. I mean, we can prove that here. You know, in terms of our freeway system, our freeway system went around Richfield. And we have spent so much money so it can go around Richfield. Didn't go straight through. There's stories about even with 94 that they relocated certain locations because of certain white communities. And, you know, we have our own example here of Rondo. So around 1975, we have, you know, a lot of the factories started closing. So we got the jobs where we talk about low education jobs, manufacturing jobs. 1971, Nixon starts his war on drugs, which when you look into the archive, was really a war on Black people. Now, 1973 is when we had the first mandatory 15 years of life. See, people think that's new, no? And when you look into the archives of that, who was usually given these sentences were Black and Latina. Now, granted, the thing is what has been proven is that whites and Blacks don't use drugs any more than each other. But this disproportionality continues. Then we have the hyper ghetto and prison era. So 1975, 1995, when it got really bad. And so around this time is when we started getting this whole deal around crack cocaine. You know, man, they talked about crack cocaine. I thought it was something other. They talked about crack. They didn't call it cocaine. I thought it was a different kind of drug. And I'm like, oh, this is, shoot, I know about this. This is cocaine. Cooked up, as we used to call it. So during the 70s, there were very little investment in the inner cities because the investment was in the suburbs. And the suburbs was the place that, you know, Black folks couldn't go or would have difficulties. So no investment, very little jobs, Vietnam vets coming back. A portion of those Vietnam vets are high on heroin because of where they were in Vietnam. No services to address that. You know, Ronald Reagan continued the war on drugs, gave us Just Say No. And that's when we first started having police officers in the schools. During the George Bush era, he supported zero tolerance with his new drug czar. Zero tolerance, even for small amounts of drugs. So now we got this new prison system that's really getting up and going. And then we have the crime bill under Bill Clinton. Now we got mandatory minimums, three strikes, right? So now, you know, we know no treatment unless you go to prison. You take these men out of the community, right? And the thing is, you take them out of the community and what are they learning while they're out of the community? Well, they're not learning how to be good citizens necessarily. But at the same time, we set these situations up where we start talking about parenting, not having fathers in the home, which the father in the home has been attacked ever since the beginning of our time here. And then you flip it and blame it on the community. So why would a crack so devastating? Because there was no compassion shown to the community. Like there's compassion shown for opioids right now. But the opioid problem was always defined as a white problem. The other thing is crack cocaine was one of the drugs that had a major effect on black women. Black women have always been the keeper of the community, keeper of the children. And so during that era, we have children trying to fend for themselves. And so you end up with what they used to, what was called the super predators, which was 16 kids. These were kids trying to survive. I don't condone behaviors that folks use to survive, but I understand with some compassion, understanding that, then you have a different approach. So now you got them with a new category for kids. Now they don't go to juvenile. They got a special category for them. So they go to big boy jail in a small room. So you got babies going to school with adults. What do you think they're going to have when they come out? But see, the thing is when you start using all these policies in terms of law and locking folks up, even good natured folks will go along with it. Well, you know, that don't seem very nice. Well, they are a little dangerous. Well, yeah, they're going to appear to be a little dangerous when you're always punishing one group and showing another group compassion. So what did we end up with? We end up with institutionalized generations. So how do we end up with that? It's because the punishment for black women having drug problems was having their kids taken. So foster care becomes a big business. Almost anybody who had a room could have the kids because they had no place to put all these children. So you got these babies raised by systems, child protection, foster care, to the point that they know the number of their social worker than they do the number of family members. And then it made it difficult for family members to even take the kids into the family, right? So I got clients that if you look in their files, they have been in all of these systems. They know more about these systems than the folks running the systems. So now we create this population and then we blame the population for being created. So all the folks that I love, well, why don't you people get over this? Well, let's look at this. So we're talking about African-Americans with chattel slavery in their lives. 246 years of chattel slavery, and that ain't, yeah, chattel slavery, we can get deeper into that. 100 years of Jim Crow and, you know, limited, you know, rights, because, you know, you had severe segregation in cities here and around the country. And so-called citizens' rights from 1965 to 2055 years, and that struggle still continues. So why do we talk about historical trauma? So we can begin the process of healing within our community, claim our cultural protective factors, stop identifying ourselves as victims. Oh, surprise, surprise. Move from identifying ourselves as survivors and be transcend that to being thrivers. So it's not about staying stuck. Because, you know, why do you talk about this trauma? Why do you, you know, I think you're just making an excuse. There's a fine line between an excuse and understanding. If I don't understand what is going on with me, it's hard, much harder to move on to healing. Chapter 2. People are trapped in the history. History is trapped in them. James Baldwin. trauma response. So the effects of historical trauma, we got the first generation post-traumatic stress disorder, generations after that, dealing with, as Dr. Braveheart calls, unresolved grief of survivors. And these are some of the symptoms here. But some additional ones is the increased physiological and sociological symptoms. So in, they include things like diabetes, which are associated with high stress hormones. So what we're finding with more research is a generational trauma actually has an effect on people's immune generations after them immune systems and might be more susceptible to certain diseases. And we're certainly seeing that as we speak with our current situation. Suspicion of institutions, because, you know, if you got this history that's passed down from one generation to another, now the services, even if services are beneficial to me, I might not be so willing. Well, why don't they take the services? Well, we need to be understanding that the history. It's like when we start talking about dealing with COVID-19 and what is coming down the line, will people take their shots? Well, in the Black community, we still ain't forgot the history of being experimented on. And Tuskegee, the experiment there. Increased alcohol and drug use. I am a licensed common pregnancy counselor. We don't talk enough about trauma. And one of the reasons in terms of our treatment, and one of the reasons I stopped doing treatment work, because folks wasn't doing enough about the relationship between trauma and drug use and how do we help folks address their trauma, which makes drug use less important. Now, I do believe in addiction, but we need to deal with the full story. Narrow sense of time, poor sense of future. If I feel like I'm going to die early and they keep saying that I'm going to die early, well, you know, if you're a young Black man, you know, you're lucky if you make it to 20. I asked a bunch of young people, if somebody convinced you that you might not make it to 20, how is that going to affect your behavior? I'm going to do everything I can do now to get it all fit in before I die. So now you're talking about a narrow sense of time. I'm not going to be planning for no future if I don't feel like I'm going to be around here very long. Chapter 3, the current look. History is not about the past, it's about the present. Dr. L.
Mr. Simmons, you got about 5 minutes if you could.
Yeah, okay. So we have adolescents between 13 and 25. The biggest things here is adultification, how culture stereotypes based on adult perception of children. So studies have shown that Black children are treated more like adults than white children, even in, and especially in the legal system. The talk, one raised to be happy, the other one is trying to figure out a way to be safe. Families shouldn't have to continue to have these talks with their children. How to, and the trauma continues. Black women with advanced degrees are more likely to lose their babies than white women with less than 8 years of schooling. And then we already know what the situation with COVID is. White people are generally allowed to have a problem, and they are historically been granted the power to define and respond to them. But people of color in this land of the free, forced through slavery and genocide, are regularly viewed and treated as the problem. D.W. Du Bois, 1897. Obstacles to healing. Well, one of the biggest things is we continue with institutional racism and oppression, the distrust of systems by African Americans, even sometimes the rejecting therapy because been convinced that being part of being Black is suffering. And so meeting the challenge. There isn't equity without people in power being willing to be uncomfortable and sit in it. So African-American community, we need to begin by healing, by acknowledging something has happened to us and is happening to us. And understand we have value and doesn't need anybody else to validate us. And we need to address and channel our rage, which includes activism and self-care strategies. And providers and policymakers have sympathy for our pain and acknowledge that it is acknowledge that there is work they need to also do around their own trauma and their bias and fear. Authentic relationship with the community with long-term investment in system change and being open to listen without being defensive in a place of in that place of discomfort. And corrective and punitive approaches without compassion exacerbates trauma symptoms and hardens negative beliefs about Black people. So if only Black people are being locked up for the same thing white folks are, then folks are always, well, maybe they are worse than us. Same exact thing. But again, if you only have corrective or punitive approaches to one group of people and not the other, you're always going to get that outcome. And so practice being a cultural broker, so owning your own understanding of yourself, being open to learning and not always put pressure on Black folks to teach you. Go outside your own, use your workspace and medias and build an authentic rapport with people of color or Black folks. And last but not least, human compassion is equal to human cruelty. It is up to us and up to us to tip the balance. Okay, wrong way. Compassion, accountability. There's always folks we don't like and people we don't understand, people who get on our nerves. But, and we can take the easy way out, but accountability without compassion is never fair and self-satisfying. Compassion without accountability calls for chaos. And sometimes in our organizations and family, we do that, but there has to be room for accountability. But without compassion, you know, where we get to pick and choose who we want to give compassion to is a problem. And going back and forth as your mood change also is inconsistent, unfair, and unclear. Compassion makes change and obstacles to change visible and invite people into the change process. You have the ability to be a resiliency factor. However, you must do your self work first. Otherwise, you can cause more problems than you are attempting to resolve. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected and are outraged as those who are. We're done.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons, for your testimony today. It was really powerful, and as a descendant of enslaved people, and also as a descendant of sharecroppers, my mother picked cotton in fields in Mississippi along with her siblings. And so when we think about that exploitation of labor, it is something that is still quite fresh for those who have experienced this within their lifetimes. And as we talk about historical trauma, it's an important reminder that it's not just about something that happened hundreds of years ago, and that the trauma and the exploitation is something that people are living with right now, today, within our communities, and that recognition is so critical. So with that, I'm going to open it up to member questions. Members, you can use the raised hand function. And it looks like we have a question from Representative Edelson.
I apologize right now. We have a pipe that broke and it's being fixed, so there's pounding. Mr. Simmons, wow, you are so inspiring, and thank you so much. I think I took pictures of every single one of your slides, so I could look back on them later today. I just want to say thank you for your expertise and for sharing that. And then I wanted to go back to the two previous speakers, Dr. Bean and Carly. You know, I was looking, we had the 11 tribes came to the legislature last term, and they we had representative, we actually, Rena, you're on the, you brought us to go and speak also to a tribal community. And one thing that I've noticed is that we don't have tribal representation at the Capitol. And I did some research and I'm like, well, why? I mean, we have Jamie Becker Finn, don't want to say that we don't have, but we have 11 tribes, but those 11 tribes don't have a seat on the state legislature. And I was looking into that, and in Maine they do. And actually in Maine in 1866, they had tribal state reps, but then they removed them in 1941 and then put them back on in 1975. And I just am wondering, what is the history of us doing this here in the state of Minnesota, if you know? And if you don't know, if we could maybe circle back, I would really love to help be a part of ensuring that we do have tribal representation, because to your point, you are the experts. You know what's happening in your community. And I think to Mr. Simmons' point is that sometimes policymakers can do more damage than good. And we really need to value Native people. And so anyways, those are my comments. So I know there's a question in there. Hopefully you got it. I apologize.
Dr. Bean or Ms. Bad-Hartpool, either of you want to respond to Rep. Edelson's?
Well, I think that my response really is I don't know, to be honest. I think that we definitely would need to look into that history a bit more and understand why some of these changes were made. And I think that we definitely have people at the Capitol today who can help work together to make sure that there is representation if that is something that people would like to do.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I think talking to representatives from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council and getting their input would be really valuable to find out. Again, like, is this something that could be powerful and that tribes would be really, really interested in doing? Or are there reasons why they wouldn't? And like Kate, I don't know the details of that, but I would be really interested in finding out. And so I do think that's a conversation that is certainly worth having.
If we could circle back, if I could talk offline with you guys, that would be really great. And then maybe Jamie Becker-Finn, I know that you do a lot of work with the tribes. So if we could circle back, that would be really helpful.
Absolutely.
And I would also mention Patina Park is also somebody that would be excellent to speak to, as well as Dr. Maddie Harper DiCarlo. We've got some great people who are working at the Capitol now, and we'd love to talk with you about it.
Rep. Lehman, you had a question for today's speakers? Rep, you're muted.
Unmute myself. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we're able to hear you now.
Great. Well, I too want to thank these speakers. I'm just furiously, I didn't think about using my camera like you did, Representative Edelson. I'm just furiously taking notes because I'm just learning so much. And as I'm hearing from the different speakers, one thing, we're talking about a systems approach, I think, here. I'm starting to think about where do we go with all of this information. And one system that keeps surfacing in these discussions, obviously, is the education system. And we keep hearing about how, you know, whether you are Native or you are Black, there's not a trust for the system. You know, I hear that from all the speakers. But my question is this. I was really interested, Dr. Bean and Carly Bad-Hartpool. You, and maybe I just didn't hear all that, but you said that you dropped out of school at age 15. And you also said you know what needs to be done, and what you're looking to us for and others is to support your work because you know what needs to be done. What I'd really like to hear from you is what's very specifically made the difference for you going back to school? What made that difference for you to have hope for the future and to advance your education?
Thank you. In a lot of ways, it was that connection to our culture and to our community. It was that, you know, remaining Indigenous peace, and we've got charter schools, we've got our own schools here in the Twin Cities and throughout
throughout the state, tribal colleges, tribal schools that are really focusing on helping our children to learn about our own histories and our own cultures and our own traditions. And different schools handle this in different ways. My children go to a Dakota immersion preschool, and they go to the a Dakota immersion school that where they are learning in their language, which is incredibly important. So I think for us, and one thing that we did mention is language is a huge piece to this, language revitalization. We only have a couple of fluent speakers left in the state, and raising that next generation of fluent speakers is really key because so many of our teachings are in the language. And I'm sure Carly would want to respond as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things you mentioned is that we know what needs to be done. And in a certain sense, we do, but we also, I also want to recognize that what needs to be done in various communities may not always look the same, right? And so the importance of speaking to folks from those communities about what is needed. You know, I come from working for many years in philanthropy in the space of education. And philanthropy is notorious for trying to finding one model that works really good someplace else and then trying to spread it, right? And that doesn't always work. And so one of the things that we did when I was at Bush and just a resource that could be helpful is we brought together Native educators from across, it was from across Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native Nations. But over the course of a year, and I think it was 2017, and it ended up with this report, and I can share a link to it, but it's a call to action, increasing opportunities for Native American student success. And so this was put out by the Bush Foundation. Our advisory group included, Dennis Olson, who was the head of, Indian Ed for the state at the time, Anna Ross, who was the head of Indian Ed for Minneapolis at the time, Dr. Teresa Peterson, Leslie Harper, Vanessa Goodthunder, a young person who's doing amazing language work. These amazing Native education experts all came together and talked about the historical analysis, but then talked about, like, what's our vision, what's our dream, and what are the challenges to getting there? And so that meant much of that is laid out in this report, but also many folks from that group continue to meet, and the folks, everybody in that group continue to work in Native education in some way, and they're working on lots of different initiatives and efforts. But like my sister said, so many of them are connected to language and culture. It really is about supporting cultural identity, supporting our kids to know who they are and to have confidence and to honor themselves as Dakota, as Anishinaabe people, because we haven't had that opportunity within the current education system as it's been set up.
And I would just mention really quick as well that, you know, something that our brother Sam here said about being in survival mode, you know, intergenerationally living in survival mode is exhausting. And being able to have that support, supporting one another is really key here. You know, our communities definitely need the support, and our educators do as well.
And that includes representation in various places. So my sister and I were successful. We ended up becoming successful within the education system because we learned how to navigate systems and we learned how to make the current systems work for us. But we couldn't do that alone. We did that because there were other Native mentors and teachers and people who helped us to figure it out so that we could figure out that, oh, at the University of Minnesota, you can do an independent study and you can go work in your community and get credit for it and have a sense of pride in what you're doing and experiential learning. Like, you know, but it takes
McNair
Scholars. It takes those opportunities. It takes those people. It takes having folks in those positions to help support our kids to make their dreams a reality.
And I'm going to interject here just because we're coming up short on time. Rep. Lehman, any follow-up to that response?
I would love to just hear a quick response from Mr. Simmons as well. If he could mention just a couple of things that he thinks would make a difference, because we're also talking about Black students. And, I mean, Minnesota is known as probably the worst state for graduation rates for Black students as well. Is there anything Mr. Simmons would want to add?
Well, I think, and I don't have a lot to add over what's already said, but the big piece is you cannot educate people you're scared of. It really, really comes down to that simple. You cannot educate people you're scared of. And you cannot educate people you refuse to understand. And so, you know, I'm probably a little bit less nice than the others, but that's what I've seen more so than anything else. And statistics have shown that. And when you bring in, remember I was talking about without compassion, you know, we've seen the numbers of punishment of kids of color. There's some compassion missing there, right? If I don't feel like everybody, if I believe anybody who works with people, if they don't believe everybody they work with deserves compassion, they shouldn't work with people. And that means compassion, even I don't like my clients. You know, I'm not kumbaya. I don't like all my clients. And because that's not my job. My job is to treat them fairly, right? That's more important. I treat them all with compassion, even the ones I don't like. And I've dealt with despicable people according to their paper. And they've all, and the most despicable ones that I had the most problems with to this day still contact me because I decided in spite of myself, in spite of my own ignorance, to show them compassion. And so some of this stuff is not that hard. But if you're refusing to deal with what's going on in with you internally, it's always going to be hard, you know, so that emotional dissonance is a big problem.
Thank you for your expansive answers. I really appreciate that. It's very helpful.
Thank you. Rep. Becker Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just kind of wanted to go off of what's already been stated by our speakers and do want to thank our chairs for bringing us really phenomenal speakers every single week in this committee. I think the testimony we heard today and previous meetings has really been some of the best testimony I've ever been lucky enough to hear in my work here at the legislature. And what I wanted to do is, you know, we spent a lot of time with the first two speakers, with Dr. Bean and with Carly, talking about history. And I wanted to make that connection with the language piece and why knowing the history is so important. The language and the cultural piece, like for example, for my own family, my grandmother was sent to a boarding school as right around the same age that my daughter is now, you know, at 5-6 years old. She lost her language. And because she lost her language because she was sent to a boarding school, my own father didn't have the language and I didn't grow up with the language. And so it's what happened, you know, 100 years ago has impacts today in the way that we're able to connect with our own community's worldview and history. And so there really is that sort of healing power in the language revitalization. It's not just, hey, it'd be nice to know Spanish. It's a really, you know, and some folks will say, well, it's not really useful because, I mean, who speaks Ojibwe or it is tied to something much bigger than that, that has ramifications when we look at the suicide rates and we look at how our young people are doing and how our communities are doing. So I wanted to make that connection with the history piece and what some of the, you know, solutions and the work are that we should really do going forward. And then finally, I just wanted to say too, you know, being well-intentioned is not enough. And so I think of, you know, one of the most significant things we've been able to do for Native folks in the last couple of years was moving forward on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. I think, you know, that's an area where, you know, from the community folks came forward and said, hey, look, this is a problem. You need to listen to us. But it isn't enough for the thing that's really easy to agree with. You know, we have to sort of, I think what Sam shared with us too, of sort of dealing with our own feelings. And I think that, that was really important to kind of, you know, we as individuals, as policymakers, need to sort of deal with that even when it's difficult. And I know this place is not, the Capitol is not usually a place where people are sort of allowed the grace to admit what they don't know and that they might be wrong, but I am hopeful that the work that we're doing in this committee can help move us this direction. So just wanted to share some of those thoughts and make some of those connections. Again, thank you very much to all of our presenters. I've been lucky enough to hear Mr. Simmons speak at previous events and was really excited to see him on the agenda, and actually was a co-clerk with Carly, thanks to Justice Ann McKeag, prior to running for office. So thank you very much for bringing them before the committee today.
Thank you, Rep. Beckerfin, for your comments. We have a number of hands raised, and so I'm going to go in order to Rep. Long. You're next on the list.
Thank you all. I'll be quick because I know we're running short of time. Thank you to all the panelists for your excellent testimony. I was really struck by the slide that showed the Fort Snelling picture and the 1970 protest, and thinking about my own city that I represent in Minneapolis, and seeing, you know, Powderhorn Park this summer with the census there showing over 50% of the residents being Native. And, you know, that history obviously has continued through generation after generation. So I'm curious what advice you would have for us as we're looking to try to deal with our current housing crisis, how we can best help the folks who in the Native community who are suffering from homelessness and might have significant distrust, and justifiably so, of the systems that, you know, the government might be able to provide.
You know, we have some amazing community members, some hard workers in our community who are working incredibly hard and are on the ground working with our community members who are currently experiencing homelessness. And I think that, again, going to our communities and going to those individuals who are on the ground doing that work, going to the organizations that are doing that work and asking them how you can support, asking what is the need, is really what needs to be done here, because the individuals who are there, they know what's needed.
Absolutely. And I just want to add, you know, Representative Beckerfin mentioned that, you know, well intentions are not enough. I agree. And also, good intentions can be really harmful. You know, you look at the out-of-home placement rates of American Indian kids. You know, ICWA was enacted because of well-intentioned, primarily white people, women who thought they were doing something good for these kids, right? And so just reiterating, super, super important to talk to the people you serve, talk to the organizations who are on the ground doing the work, connecting with folks who are living in those tents, because there's not going to be one right answer. There's not going to be one solution. That's why we brought this huge multitude of issues to talk about today, and we didn't even get to another whole bucket, like multiple buckets, right, that are out there. There's a lot that needs to be addressed. And unfortunately, because of the historic challenges we've faced, because of the historic under-resourcing, often folks who are working in one issue area feel like they're in competition with folks in another issue area. And we need to be supporting folks to come together. We need to be supporting efforts that are coordinated efforts that are looking at the bigger picture. Because again, it's not one person, it's not one organization, it's not one model that's going to fix this. It's going
to
take some work.
I'm sorry to interject. We've got other hands.
No, absolutely. Okay.
I need to move us along here. Unfortunately, I apologize for that. Rep. Cagle, did you have a question?
I was just kind of thinking throughout this whole process about how, you know, people don't like to have their biases pointed out. And I was just really struck by Mr. Simmons's comments about compassion. And so, kind of going through this whole process this year, and really trying to, make a conscious effort of, like, you know, just, it's just that whole unconscious bias piece and making people realize that. But how do you do that without making people feel bad? I don't know. And just, Mr. Simmons, when you talked about the compassion that you need to have, I think that's something that's really lacking right now. and it's sad. Sorry, there wasn't really a question in there, so I apologize.
No, appreciate the comment. Next on the list, I've got Representative Damath, Vice Chair Damath.
Thank you, Co-Chair Richardson. I just want to make a brief comment, and then I have a couple other statements to make, but I just wanted to let the committee know also that Representative Erdahl had to leave this call early. As much as he was engaged, there's work that's being done with the bonding leads, and so he wasn't able to stay to the very end. But the work that is being done on this committee is so valuable, and I continue to feel honored to sit on this committee and to participate in the conversations. To our three testifiers today, the information that you brought forward about historical trauma and the details and how they affect Minnesota are so valuable. And I believe it was Carly that just said, we've only scratched the surface, that there's a whole other bucket that we didn't get to yet. There's still so much that needs to be done. For our last few hearings, we've laid that general groundwork for the context of racial justice issues that are prevalent in so many of our systems throughout the communities within our state. In my experience, systems are generally designed to get the results that they seek to achieve, but I'm committed to digging deeper into each system. As we've heard today, from the education system to the effects on healthcare, I wanna see us develop positive and sustainable solutions that will address causes of racial justice and solutions for them. So I again thank you for today's topic of how this has impacted both past generations and future. It's significant to the overall conversation of racial justice, and I believe that has provided our committee more insight to do the work that we need to do. So again, thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Damath, for your words. We are running a few minutes over, so we'll ask for the indulgence of the members as we get some final comments from Co-Chair Moran.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Co-Chair, Chair. So I just want to say to our speakers, our testifier, thank you. Mr. Sam Simmons, for your words and your wisdom, your insight into just laying out clarity around historical trauma for the Black community, for the African-American community. To Dr. Kate Bean, thank you for your words and your insight. It's just awesome. And to Carla Bedhart-Bull, I love that name. I mean, I just want to know about that name. Bedhart-Bull. Thank you. Thank you, sisters, for your work and for your leadership and for bringing what is needed for the indigenous community to thrive and to tell that history. I really appreciate that so much. And I don't have much more to say than Representative Damon, you know, your words was a ditto to all that you just stated. I'm just going to mention the educational piece because I know education, as we look at racism and structural racism, that is what it is for us as legislators. When we talk about systems, for us as legislators, we are the system. We have a role to play to really begin to break down the structural racism that we see that are embedded within all of our systems. And we have a huge role to play. You know, education is just not about the classroom. Education is a continuum that happens, not just in the classroom. And I know for myself and Vice Chair Damon and Co-Chair Richardson, you know, and I might have said this before, but when we think about this committee, Select Committee on Racial Justice, it's not as easy as being a chair of any other committee, not even chair of Health and Human Service. Because I'm making decisions based on legislators who are introducing bills, right? But we are trying to create a narrative and tell a story and to educate, right? It's an educational piece that we're hoping that happens here. Because unless each one of us are open to getting information that we did not learn in school, that is still part, still is not part of our educational system. And it is through those that we bring before us that we will continue to expand our educational knowledge around structural racism and how it impacts children, family, women, men, communities across the state of Minnesota. So I am just so grateful for each one of our speakers today. I am really, you guys just don't know how grateful I am for each one of you legislators for stepping into this role, to play a role in how we can begin to educate ourselves to move forward as state legislators. So thank you all. And to our co-chair, Representative Ruth Richardson, I pass it on to you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran, for those final words. And one final thank you to today's speakers. We powerful testimony, and I know that it's really hard to try to talk about historical trauma under such tight time limits. So we appreciate you being willing to share your stories and to share your perspective today. One quick announcement for members and for the public. Just wanted to go over really quickly the public testimony details for next week on October 13th, next Tuesday. The entire hearing is devoted to public testimony. Members of the public and organizations are invited to provide up to 3 minutes of testimony. Due to the nature of remote hearings, those wishing to testify must sign up no later than Monday, October 12th, 2020, at 5 p.m., and that can be done by emailing CLA Bentaconte at house.mn. Those who are unable to testify via Zoom may either email written testimony to the CLA, again, that's benta.conte at house.mn, or provide testimony via voicemail. Ensure that that voicemail is no longer than 3 minutes, and that can be provided to 651-296-8827. That number is 651-296-8827. And written testimony will be posted and provided to committee members. On the committee webpage, you will also find these details listed out related to the public testimony next week. There being no other business before the committee, we are now adjourned, and our next hearing is 1 week from today, October 13th, 2020, at 1 p.m. Thank you all.